Écoute, Laurent, please rise. Ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki ike hana hana ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. E noho I lalo, please be seated.
All right, please call the case.
SCAP-23-000453, Casey Cameron Eason, appellee petitioner versus State of Hawaii, appellant respondent. Arguing for appellant respondent, State of Hawaii, Charles Murray. Arguing for appellee petitioner, Casey Cameron Eason, Catherine Gibson. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good afternoon. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We have allocated 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Murray, we're going to give you a warning with 20 minutes in, so you can reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Gibson, we will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, fellow justices, counsel, Ms. Gibson. just as in the case of Ex parte Kaiser and In re Kim, Mr. Eason here is not seeking justice, but he seeks an escape from justice. And his means of that escape is provided by this court in Rule 40 of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure. And he used it to convince the circuit court, all evidence to the contrary, that his original change of plea in 2004, March 31st of 2004, was not voluntary, that his change of plea colloquy was deficient, and that he was coerced into pleading no contest. However, none of those things are true, and the record and the facts and evidence show that not to be true. But more importantly, and more foundationally, Rule 40 itself is an illegal, unconstitutional method used by the defendant to overturn his conviction. There is no statutory authorization for it. It directly contradicts the statutes found in Chapter 660 and 641 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. Those statutes were passed by the legislature and formulate the procedures for both appeals of criminal convictions as well as habeas corpus.
Are you suggesting that this court does not have the authority to promulgate rules of practice and procedure?
I'm arguing that this court does not have power or authority under Chapter 602, Section 11, to promulgate a rule like
What about
rule
the Constitution?
40.
Doesn't that prevail over any statute?
It would, yes. But
what about Article 6, Section 7?
As this court stated in Obrero, rules of penal procedure cannot overcome statutes. And Statute 602.11 reiterates that because it says that rules of penal procedure cannot abridge, modify, or expand the rights of party litigants. Statute 602.11 says the rules of courts cannot expand the jurisdiction of courts. Rule 40 does all of those things. Rule 40 grants party litigants the ability to challenge convictions outside of those found in Chapter 660 and Chapter 641. And more importantly, it also expands the jurisdiction of the circuit courts to overturn convictions in defiance of Section 641, Chapter 641, excuse me. And above and beyond that, it also expands the power of the ICA and the Supreme Court to hear appeals. There's nothing found in the statutes that grants this court or the ICA the ability to hear an appeal of something like a Rule 40. In fact, it's quite clear that the only thing that is appealable in a criminal case by the defendant is his conviction, his sentence, the judgment, or an interlocutory appeal of certain specific types of rulings, like a motion to suppress, perhaps, under limited circumstances. The state can only appeal a very set, limited number of things as well. None of those things are something like Rule 40. And yet Rule 40 grants this court, as well as the ICA, the ability to hear such appeals.
Mr. Murray, so when Rule 40 was adopted as part of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure in 1977, at that time, Hawaii's courts were already addressing habeas corpus writs, which sought to vacate convictions based on, for instance, constitutional violations, right? I mean, it's not something that was created by Rule 40.
That's correct. But
I mean, isn't another fair reading of Rule 40 that what it did was to provide sort of like a uniform procedure for addressing petitions or writs along the lines of habeas corpus, quorum nobis, those types of actions?
I would argue it didn't provide a procedure where one was lacking. It replaced a procedure that already existed by statute with a new.
Okay, but the Constitution says that the rulemaking power of this court is to create rules as to procedure process in any courts.
As long as they don't conflict with statutory requirements.
I don't think that's what it says.
Well, that's what the statute 60211 says. It's what Obrero determined. It's what's been decided in other Supreme Court cases regarding the rules passed by this court or issued by this court. Chapter 660, which governs habeas corpus, specifically lays out numerous means of carrying out, you know, a habeas petition. First, the habeas petition is addressed to the person holding the person in custody, not the state, not the prosecutor, which that's a big change. That's not just a process or procedure change. That's a substantive change that Rule 40 makes. Second, Rule 40 requires evidentiary hearings when a petition is not patently frivolous. However, Chapter 660 says that the courts can rule summarily. They don't need to have a hearing. A judge doesn't need to hold a hearing.
How does that comply with due process? Doesn't this court have the prerogative to determine what satisfies due process?
That is true. If there was a challenge to the statute in Chapter 660, the fact that the court can say Chapter 660 doesn't comport with due process does not thereby grant the court the power to create a new, different process, whole cloth, which is what the court did with Rule
40. Has the legislature in the last several decades ever tried to take any action to overturn Rule 40?
No, it has not, and neither did it try to overturn Rule 7. But Obrero still said that that was no safe harbor.
Well, look, you know, Obrero was a square-on direct conflict. You had a statute that said grand jury, and you had a rule that said no grand jury. It was pretty black and white on the square-on, irreconcilable conflict. I don't see that here. I mean, can you explain how there is an exact conflict?
I do see it, quite frankly. Here, Obrero, you're right, did not. There was a statute directly on point, but there was also a constitutional amendment that disagreed, arguably, with Obrero, in which the legislature then used to change the law after Obrero. Here, the appeals in Chapter 641, Chapter 641 says specifically that the only vehicle for overturning a criminal conviction is through the appeals process by the ICA or the Supreme Court. Only the ICA and the Supreme Court can modify or repudiate, you know, overturn a criminal conviction.
But okay, if that space is wide open, then why wouldn't that violate the due process clause? Sort of what Justice McKenna was asking you.
That's a fair question, but that's not the issue here. The issue here is, does the court, the Supreme Court, have in its power to create a totally new process, a totally new procedure, grant itself new jurisdiction that is not previously granted by the legislature to address it?
But wasn't there always the ability of post-conviction relief? I mean, it's almost like you're suggesting, okay, let's take an example. What is probably the most common post-conviction relief? It's alleging ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think under your position, it would seem that those ineffective assistance of counsel cases would all have to be raised on direct appeal. And that's really unworkable because the record really wouldn't be able to afford the defendant the ability to establish that Sixth Amendment claim.
Well, yes, it is. It would be challenging. It's not, I wouldn't say it's always unworkable. It happens. I've seen cases, and I'm sure the court is aware, there are cases where ineffective assistance is raised for the first time, is raised on appeal.
And it certainly you can. One yes. can elect
and
to
the,
go that route.
This court, the ICA, has the power to return things to the circuit court if there needs to be a hearing on it. That's well within its powers. But I would also argue that under the traditional view of habeas corpus, there could be room to address those issues, ineffective assistance of counsel in particular, because that is something that would be outside the record. In this case, the ineffective assistance of counsel issue was addressed by the court as well as the other issues, and the circuit court didn't find any ineffective assistance of counsel. So there was nothing outside the record, so to speak, here. So
newly discovered evidence that grounds that your position is the same way, that there's somehow some carve out somewhere.
I mean, I believe the traditional view of habeas corpus allows for those specific carve outs. I don't think Rule 40 is necessary for those carve outs, for those situations.
But isn't Rule 40 just simply when you cut to the chase of Rule 40, it's just the procedures for raising a post-conviction relief motion, isn't it?
It's not just the procedures. It dictates how it's done. It dictates who does it. It dictates that there must be evidentiary hearings, which the habeas corpus statutes don't require. It changes the jurisdiction of this court and the ICA to hear appeals that are not otherwise granted. And appeals, as this court has said, are confined to statute. There has to be a statutory authorization for an appeal.
If Rule 40 is out, though, I mean, there's other – Rule 40 covers not only post-conviction relief motions. It covers, you know, issues of confinement and all sorts of things of that nature. What does your idea do with respect to those types of situations?
Chapter 660 already covers all those. That's what habeas corpus has always traditionally been about.
And does those habeas corpus in the chapter have any type of procedural mechanisms and ground rules for the petitioner to raise and to, you know, funnel their case up to us?
Yes. I mean, the rules are there from 663, which deals with the form of the complaint or the petition, all the way to the nature and contents of the return filed by the holding party, the party that has custody of the body, and section 17 and 18, which that's the reply, and then the issue of whether evidence is even necessary or hearings are necessary in section 24. And then it also deals with what are the results? What is the court allowed to do? It's allowed to release the person. It's allowed to release them on bail, or it's allowed to return them to the custody.
Could change gears to one of the other issues. What's your position with regard to the question of waiver in this case? In other words, the arguments that Mr. Eason could have raised but didn't adequately raise, the questions that are here before us today. What's your sort of take of where the circuit court went wrong on that?
I think the circuit court ignored fundamentally the entire history of Mr. Eason's Rule 40 petitions in the past, as well as his own testimony in the hearing and the facts and records. Mr. Eason filed a Rule 40 in 2008, 3 years after his sentencing. In it, he alleged that his minimum was set too high. In his Rule 40 petition in 2008, he actually argued that he should have had a level 2 minimum, not a level 3 minimum, which meant he fully understood that he was in prison for life and that he was going to have the ability for parole. He understood all that, which is a claim he later rejected or argued that he didn't understand when it came to this Rule 40. He also, in the history of this case, at sentencing, he was told repeatedly, the sentence for murder 2 is life with the possibility of parole. At his change of plea, at his sentencing, the records from Mr. Olson confirmed that he was informed of all that. He knew what he was getting way before he filed this petition and claimed he didn't know. And the records and files of all of these things that were taken into consideration show that, but the circuit court, for some reason, ignored that. and chose to believe what he said in his testimony over the facts from decades of litigation and records.
What about the lack of transcripts and how dispositive that should be for our consideration in this case?
It shouldn't be dispositive at all, because the law says, Boykin says, first off, Boykin was about a direct appeal, not a collateral appeal like a habeas.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Boykin, which mentioned the lack of transcript, lack of record, it was a direct appeal, not a collateral review. Still, it said that you can't base a decision on a silent record of whether there was a valid change of plea. This is not a silent record. We have a change of plea form. We have court minutes that were made contemporaneously with the change of plea. We have the sentencing report, which itself reiterates many of the things that were gone over in the change of plea. You have the contemporary records from Mr. Olson that were accepted by the court, which also confirmed that there was a valid change of plea colloquy, that Mr. Eason understood what he was getting into, what he was getting by pleading no contest, and that he was going to be convicted, that he was going to have life in prison with the possibility of parole, and that there wouldn't be a chance for him to, quote unquote, present his evidence later. That's all there.
What about the discrepancies that are pointed out from the plea form, where it talked about probation, not more than a year in prison, missing his grade, you know, his education level, then it was mentioned he was on medication, but, you know, we don't have any information because of the lack of record on what kind of medication, did it affect his ability to comprehend and understand? How does that play into the analysis?
I'll concede it wasn't a perfect record. Rarely do you find perfect records in criminal cases, I would argue. But it is a sufficient record, and that's all that we need. And here, many of those issues are addressed in either contemporaneous records kept by Mr. Olson, including declarations he filed with the court. There are also the issues about, the change of plea form said probation, but that wasn't a possible sentence. The court addressed that at sentencing. The PSI report addressed that at sentencing. Mr. Eason knew that when he was interviewed by the PSI writer for the sentencing report. He knew that he was going to prison for life with the possibility of parole. And he acknowledged that to that writer. So there's records showing that even with flaws in the change of plea form, Mr. Eason knew what he was doing. There was no coercion. There was no trick or confusion about what he
faced. There was some coercion from the mother.
That is purely, there was no information about that in the record. That is something that came out in testimony, certainly. I would argue that there was evidence from the time period as well as evidence from Mr. Olson and testimony that contradicts the idea that she coerced Mr. Eason into changing his plea.
By the way, you mentioned time frame. It seems very unorthodox to me that the court would have the defendant, the defense attorney, and the court talking, wherever they were talking, for 45 minutes right before the change of plea. Is that something common in the Third Circuit?
I've never seen it, but that's not in the record, obviously. I think that it was unusual. Mr. Olson even referred to it as unusual at the time. I also believe, though, that here the circuit court ignored contemporaneous evidence, Mr. Olson's records, that indicated specifically what that was about. If I can have a moment.
You know, while you're looking, I think Mr. Olson said in the 40 years that was the first time that it ever happened.
Yes.
I remember reading the record accurately.
What I believe that was concerning, though, was Mr. Eason's waiver of an argument. And Mr. Olson's records indicate that what that was about was Mr. Olson felt a little uncomfortable based on things that Mr. Eason had told him in confidence, and the court ordered Mr. Olson to put it in a declaration under seal, which Mr. Olson did, and that there would be a closed hearing. And that basically the gist of that was about making sure Mr. Eason understood that he was waiving a valid defense by changing his plea, a specific defense.
It wasn't a harder related motion, you know.
I'm sorry.
It wasn't like a motion to withdraw type of a situation where I know there was some of those going on. Can I get back to the transcript issue that's sort of a little bit touching on what the Chief Justice said? You know, It seems that Eason, from a long period of time, at least maybe as far as 2011, okay, is trying to get the transcripts and, you know, doing what he can to get the transcripts, thinking it might help him somehow. Now, he got most of the transcripts of the, I guess, the trial proceeding, or it wasn't trial, but earlier proceedings, but he couldn't get those transcripts, and he was trying, and then the court, he even did an interlock in the murder case itself versus the Rule 40 case, and I'm just wondering, you know, if he had the transcript, he did it within that 10-year time frame, it still would have, if he was given the transcript or allowed access to a transcript, it wouldn't have been destroyed by then.
Right.
Does that impact anything for
I don't think it should. I wish he'd gotten the transcript, because I believe the transcript would show exactly what we're arguing, that there was a voluntary change of plea, that it comported with what was on the change of plea formed for the, you know, except with the changes, and they would have explained those changes. Unfortunately, outside the power of the state, at least the prosecution, that record was destroyed.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Sorry,
just one more. You know, I mean, essentially, you're saying there's a waiver. I mean, it seems like that's your main point. And then
there is a record. It's not the transcripts, but there is still a record.
In other words, there's a direct appeal. There's two Rule 40s, and you're saying there's no extraordinary circumstances. Now, let's say there was a petitioner in Kona who had never raised or never, and he's in jail. He's a cigarro now. He's serving life. He never actually has filed a Rule 40. Is this going to pose problems because there's no records?
Yes, it could. Absolutely. Anything more than 20 years old, if I was a defendant, I would take advantage of it.
Thank you. I just wanted to be clear on the timing, which is, yes, Mr. Eason, I think around 2011 was filing motions to try to get the transcripts. Various things happened there. The records, the transcript that we're talking about wasn't destroyed, if I remember, until 2019. There was a period in 2015 when he was represented, as I understand it, and was asking that attorney to get the transcripts. Is that correct?
That's what I understand.
So prior to the records actually being destroyed, he was represented by counsel.
Yes.
And they never went after the transcripts at that point.
I'm not sure if they never went after him. I don't understand why they weren't retrieved at that point.
I thought she said it was beyond the scope of her retention.
Yes.
Which is a pretty limited scope, I imagine, of retention. Jeez.
Is that a factor? Is that an extraordinary factor?
I don't think so, because it still goes to the core of the issue of waiver. Mr. Eason knew exactly what was going on in 2004, and 2008, and 2009, and 2010. He said in his testimony and the Rule 40, I always knew something was wrong. And knowing that there's an issue and not acting on it for almost 20 years is a knowing and understanding waiver of that issue, especially when you have acted on three other things in the same time period and never brought it up. Thank you.
Very well. Anything more for the court at this point?
Or? No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Gibson.
May it please the court. Chief Justice Rechtenwald, justices, good afternoon. My name is Catherine Gibson. I'm the court-appointed attorney for petitioner appellee Casey Eason. Your Honors, next Monday, March 31st, will mark 21 years to the day that Mr. Eason entered his no-contest plea, that the court took his no-contest plea without making an on-the-record determination as to his mental competency. We're here today because Mr. Eason properly sought relief under the Rules of Penal Procedure, Rule 40. Mr. Eason sought to withdraw his plea. He raised two issues. One was the legality of the court accepting his plea while proceedings were suspended under Hawaii Revised Statute 704 for an exam, a mental exam of the petitioner. The second was that his no contest plea was not made voluntarily and knowing. In 2023, the circuit court granted the petition. This returned Mr. Eason to pre-trial status, no bail. Today, we ask the court to affirm the circuit court's ruling for three reasons. The record below demonstrates that there was bona fide questions regarding Mr. Eason's mental competency. The trial court's failure, Judge Ibarra, Third Circuit Court, in 2004, the failure to make a finding of fitness prior to accepting his plea violated due process. The circuit court in 2023 also found that the circumstances surrounding Mr. Eason's plea, the evidence adduced at the hearing on this petition, and the record below cast a long shadow of doubt as to the voluntariness and the knowing nature of his plea. Third, this petition is properly brought under Rules of Penal Procedure, Rule 40. This is the mechanism for post-conviction constitutional challenges. Rule 40 does not conflict with the requirements of the statute so as to offend HRS 60211. That prohibits court-promulgated rules from abridging, enlarging, or modifying the substantive right of any litigant. That is not the case here. There is no direct conflict. I would like to correct that Mr. Eason was appointed or was represented by counsel in 2015 when he was seeking transcripts. He had made various attempts to obtain transcripts, one of which was asking his trial counsel, Mr. Olson, for a copy of the record. Mr. Olson said, "I have already given you a copy." Mr. Eason sought assistance with the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, who replied, Mr. Olson does not have a duty to procure transcripts for you. When the COVID pandemic hit, the federal government issued checks, and prisoners were among the recipients of those checks. Mr. Eason received money that he had not previously had. He wanted to use that money to hire an attorney to get the transcripts. His mother tried to talk him out of it. She said, "Are you sure this is how you want to use this money?" And he said, "Yes, this is important to me." They hired an attorney. And when it became evident to Mr. Eason that the attorney was not pursuing the transcripts, that was what he needed. And that is why he let her go. So it was.
Sorry, can I ask you about the competency?
Yes.
You know, the record indicates there's three doctors and I think an additional one that the his attorney retained, and they all said he was fit to proceed. What's the relevance of that?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
As far as your argument that he was not fit, we know on the record there wasn't a determination on the record, but all the other evidence seems to indicate that he was fit to proceed.
There were, as I counted, seven doctors. There's a lengthy, when we're looking at the record of this case from July 2003 up until when he entered his no contest plea, 7 or 8 months, that was suspended. And one of the issues in this case was that the doctors were asked to opine regarding an element of the charge. And some of the doctors said, "That's beyond what we're qualified to do. We cannot opine on the
heat." But Mr. Eason himself, is he claiming he was unfit? Because that wasn't part of his earlier
Your
petitions,
Honor,
was it?
If you look at the record, there is a question as to his fitness. There, if you look at Mr. Olson's own representations to the court, when he is asking the court, "Please don't send him back to the jail on Hawaii Island, please send him to Oahu." On Oahu, he was at OCCC, he was able to get proper medication and treatment. Mr. Olson noticed a change. His words were a regression. And this happened right before, just 2 weeks or 3 weeks, if I'm correct, before the change of plea. So there are legitimate questions on the record. There was prior involuntary commitment. He was under the care of a psychologist. There was a suicide attempt. There were reported auditory and...
Right, but in the four petitions he filed, did he raise fitness, competency as an issue?
Your Honor, the prior petitions, I don't believe that he did. I think that he had misrepresented at one point that he thought that the doctors had found him unfit. That's not correct. The doctors, all three doctors, did opine that they considered him fit. But that is an opinion, and that was going to be a contested issue. Mr. Olson, his defense attorney, asked for a contested hearing because he wanted to explore that issue based on his own observations, based on questions about the medication change.
But then they ended up waiving the third.
That's what the record suggests, that there was a waiver. I think what the circuit court correctly ruled was that that waiver itself should be questioned because the issue of competency had not been determined. Due process.
Well, it actually had by the other four doctors. They said he was fit.
The doctors had opined that he was fit, but the parties, the defense attorney and the prosecutor, did not stipulate to the findings. Rather, the defense attorney wanted to question that and wanted to have an evidentiary hearing. And until the court makes the finding, it's an opinion. It's a doctor's opinion. Judge Ibarra did not have a hearing of competency and did not make a finding. And if I may return to the court's question about the waiver, well, didn't he waive it? And why can't we trust these reports? The waiver of the third panel should be questioned simply because there is an issue as to his competency, which had not been determined. And due process requires a hearing and a finding on the record of competency.
One of the things, though, is that the change of plea hearing, which is the hearing which the transcript is missing, I mean, that potentially could address this fitness question, right? I mean, isn't that like a question mark as to what was actually discussed at that hearing, including fitness?
It is a question mark, and I think it's one problem that we don't have transcripts. It's not the only problem. We can try, and I think that the court and the parties did try to piece together what really happened. Okay, well, we don't have a transcript. Is the record really minimal or silent, or what does the record say? Well, when we turn to the other pieces of the record, we can't rely on what we have. The court found that because of the passage of time, people's memories have, of course, degraded. But when we look at what we do have, we have the change of plea form rife with problems. We have the unusual situation where the defense attorney had filed three motions to withdraw. We have the highly unusual conversation with the mother.
But I think that's the interesting thing about this case, which is, I think as Justice Evans was saying, say somebody just waits 25 years to bring a petition. You don't have a transcript. I mean, are we then to just assume the worst? I mean, you know what I mean? That's the challenge in this case, I think. And we do have some records. But the assumption, I think, that was made at the circuit court level is because there's no actual record of a finding of fitness that we have to sort of presume unfitness. And therefore, he couldn't have knowingly waived his Rule 40, his right to bring those issues in prior Rule 40 petitions. Isn't that what happened?
I don't know if there's a presumption that he was unfit, but when we certainly look at the record, we have to say there's a bona fide doubt as to his fitness, and that there's evidence in the record that court could have found him fit. There's also evidence in the record that he could have been found unfit.
Let me ask you it this way, which is for 17 years about after his change of plea until he brought the 2021 petition, we talk about burdens in the Rule 40. Isn't it Mr. Easton's burden to show that he was unfit during that time period, to establish or to overcome the presumption that he knowingly waived those arguments that he now brings as constitutional violations?
I don't believe that it's his burden to show that he was unfit. And I don't think that we could make that finding either way. We don't know if he was, we don't know if he wasn't.
No, but I'm not talking about at the time he made his change of plea. I'm talking about since that time that he has been sentenced, convicted, and he's claiming all this time he couldn't have knowingly waived his right to bring these Rule 40 claims because, I guess now because of the circuit court's finding, the position is I was never found fit at the change of plea, so there you go.
Is the court asking why doesn't he need to show?
Isn't that the burden under Rule 40 for the petitioner to show that they can overcome the presumption that they made a knowing waiver? Because clearly he brought four petitions before the 2021 petition.
Your Honor.
Right, which didn't raise these claims that are now before us, right?
And generally the burden is on the petitioner. And in this matter, petitioner did bring forth enough evidence to rebut the presumption. There is, when the record is minimal or silent, then the burden shifts to the prosecution to show that his plea was not voluntary. And so when we're talking about Rule 40, I know that there's a concern of, well, now we know that that transcripts are missing from all these other cases. Is this going to open the floodgates? And it's not easy to bring a Rule 40. I think it would be very interesting to see the number that are filed when the court looks, how many are actually granted a hearing. It's a very small number. The court has to look at, are there issues of constitutional nature that, if were proven true, would warrant relief. And the court can also find that those issues brought forth are frivolous and that there is no basis for them.
Are you asking the court to recognize some sort of presumption if there is no record of the colloquy? Or is it that we can look at other parts of the record to see if we can piece together exactly what happened, if there was sufficient evidence to show that there was a knowing and voluntary and intelligent
I think plea? That this court and the lower court is required to look at the entirety of the record. And Judge Deweese looked at the entirety of the record. This record includes petitions, it includes appeals. So I believe that the court must look at the entirety of the record, and I believe that that was done when Mr. Eason's request for relief was granted.
And when you look at the record, you have the plea form, which he signed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he acknowledges that the form, the substance, it was covered with him by both judge and his attorney. And the attorney attested that he had gone over the form 3-4 times within the 3-4 months prior to that. He had the minutes that reflect, you know, voluntary, intelligent, knowing change of plea. Why isn't that sufficient?
You have the plea form, and the issue, again, this is why the transcript of the hearing would be vital, because Mr. Eason, at the hearing on this matter, he testified, I did think I understood what it meant. I thought I knew what I was doing. I thought I understood. He actually, as an example, believed that parole meant a lifetime of supervision. It's unclear if he knew the difference between parole and probation, a life of supervision. And so.
And the attorney said he explained all of that.
Yes. And the record shows that Mr. Olson, first of all, very experienced, litigated this case very hard, but also described it as unusual and exhausting right before the change of plea, that the communication between them had been had disintegrating. Also, if we look at Mr. Olson's own words, his representations were that the client had been regressing, that there are concerns about his fitness, that medication had been stopped completely, or one other medication had been cut in half. Judge Ibarra sua sponte raised the issue about the staleness of the reports. So this gets back to the question about, well, why can't we just trust the reports? The reports had been done perhaps months earlier. And so his medication had been changed.
What about, you know, aside from the things that Justice Devens cataloged, this case, you know, had, as you say, some extraordinary types of circumstances. I don't mean extraordinary circumstances in the Rule 40 sense, but Judge Ibarra had a fair amount of interaction with this defendant on the motions to withdraw immediately before that 45-minute meeting that I referred to. He engages in a colloquy. He makes a finding that the person in front of me that I'm eyeballing, we don't know exactly what the colloquy was, but, you know, Judge Ibarra made a finding that it was knowing and voluntary, intelligent waiver. You also have defense counsel right next to this person. Would it be incompetent person to plead guilty or no contest?
Defense counsel must certify that the plea is made knowing and voluntary. And I believe that the record shows that Mr. Olson went forward with the plea. I don't believe that he knew or thought that Mr. Olson was, that Mr. Eason was incompetent, but the record also shows that there was very good questions, long-standing questions about his fitness. The circuit court looked at the rushed nature of this plea, and you know, it's something we all learn about in first-year contracts of be careful when you're under pressure to do something quickly. And that is the impression that the circuit court got in this case, that the nature of this change of plea hearing was highly unusual, that it was rushed, that it was emotional. Mr. Eason himself testified, I always knew something was wrong.
But isn't that what Mr. Murray's saying suggests that he knew and should have raised that issue in, you know, before now?
And our position is that he did try to raise the issue. There were multiple attempts to get the transcript because, again, he thought, I have to see it, right? Out of respect for what's required for Rule 40, I have to see what occurred. And those attempts to get the transcript, unfortunately, by the time that he and his mother realized that the transcripts did not exist, that they were not just simply under seal, then they had been destroyed.
Ms. Gibson, the first motion, though, to get those transcripts, I believe was in 2011, those are all after the four prior petitions were filed and decided. Is that the status of the record? Certainly well after the four petitions were filed, right?
Your Honor, when you look at the record, it does appear that there were multiple attempts, but when we look at the requirements of Rule 40, they have to be actually raised. The issues have to be actually raised and then or waived. And so Mr. Eason, I think that the circuit court engaged in the proper analysis to determine that in this case, waiver, although normally a threshold issue to even see if we can hear this Rule 40 case, that because of the problem, the issue of his unaddressed fitness, the violation of his due process rights to have that issue determined.
No, I understand that. My question simply is, though, by the time he was trying to get the transcripts, that was all after the four prior petitions were filed, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so.
I mean, I get your point. I know your point is as to the fitness, but I'm just trying to really understand.
I think that he had been, there is on the record that he had been making requests with the circuit court to obtain the transcripts, and those had been denied. There was a ruling by Judge Strantz that, you know, one thing that was not a Rule 40 petition, she said that was just an attempt to get the transcripts. And
Those are in the 2011 time period or before?
I believe it was before, Your Honor, in 2000. There was a special proceeding in 2008. There was an appeal of a denial. There was another special proceeding in 2009, an appeal of a denial, and then in 2010. That 2010 petition, that was when Mr. Eason possibly raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, but that again was not found by the circuit court to be an issue. And Mr. Eason chose to raise it in this because he is aware now that any issue not raised is waived.
Do you think the series of events related to obtaining the transcript, I guess the mom trying to get the transcript, the filing of a request in a case that was already POW, the lawyer, and I think the lawyer that you discussed, I think you said it was in 2020, but I think if I understand, Cynthia Kagiwada was retained in 2016 by the mom and declined to get the transcripts as being beyond the scope of what she was hired for. Is that series of events enough to constitute an exceptional circumstance?
Your Honor, the exceptional circumstance, first of all, thank you for correcting me that Ms. Kagiwada was in 2016. Ms. Terry Fujioka Lilly was hired after the COVID check right. came, and that's who ultimately determined when we determined when it was discovered that the transcripts had been destroyed. To get to the question about extraordinary circumstances, other courts have found that there's no specific rubric as to what constitutes an extraordinary circumstance. But in this case, defense or our position would be that the efforts to get the transcript would constitute an extraordinary circumstance, even though the court does not even need to find that there are extraordinary circumstances in this. Some extraordinary circumstances have been, for example, an attorney being begged by his client, please don't wait till the last day to file the brief, and then the attorney assuring him, oh, I won't, don't worry. Well, then the attorney did wait until the last day, and it turns out that that was the day after. And the court found that that was because it was not the fault of the petitioner, and petitioner had exercised due diligence that equitably the period should be extended. That was one example of an extraordinary circumstance. So in this situation, the transcripts and the efforts that petitioner took from being incarcerated, trying to find these transcripts, which the record suggests he did believe existed, were just sealed, would be considered an extraordinary circumstance. Unless there's no further questions, I would just ask that this court does affirm the circuit court's ruling. The purpose of Rule 40 is to ensure the integrity of convictions. And until the legislator acts and limits Rule 40 or does away with it, this is what we have been telling people who are convicted in this state. This is the means that they seek relief. In 2009, Mr. Eason appealed a case, and the prosecution said he is free to raise any issues on a Rule 40 petition. He has done that now. And now the prosecution is saying that Rule 40 is invalid, and he cannot seek relief. This goes to fairness. A person should be able to trust the rules, have stability, be able to know I can seek relief in the way that I have been told to do so that is available to me. Mr. Eason took a risk in filing this. He faces, if the court affirms the circuit court's ruling, he faces very serious charges, but it's important to him and it's important to our system that his plea, when he enters it, if he enters it, if he entered it, that it needs to be voluntary and knowing, that it needs to be his decision, not made under pressure, not made because his mother was begging him to take it, and especially made when he's found competent by a court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Gibson. Mr. Murray, your rebuttal.
I want to start by addressing something that was mentioned by multiple justices regarding the issue of what happens now. What happens now if the court decides that, yes, Mr. Eason, the Rule 40 is valid, Mr. Eason should be released. A floodgate happens because anyone who's been in custody for 20 years and knows the transcript's gone can file a Rule 40 petition. And that right there goes to the core of the problem with Rule 40 itself. Rule 40 is the issue. Rule 40 is not just a matter of process and procedure. If it's just a matter of process and procedure, then why isn't the method of bringing a person before the court on a criminal matter just an issue of process and procedure? Brero said that's not, you have to go to grand jury. But whether or not you go to grand jury, you have a complaint where in a preliminary hearing, there's still probable cause. That's the substantive right, is probable cause. It goes beyond that. It's not just a matter of process and procedure. Anything can become a matter of process and procedure if the court's going to expand that definition so broadly as to cover Rule 40 and say that it is a method of process and procedure for a habeas corpus. The court, it's...
If all proceedings under Rule 40 are, have been invalid for the last 50 years, what would... defendants then be able to invoke their full range of remedies under the statute?
They should be able to, yes. If they relied, I believe a fair outcome would be to, if they relied on Rule 40 when they should have went through Chapter 660, they should be allowed to go through Chapter 660. And I don't believe there's anything today that would prevent someone from filing, like Mr. Eason, 20 years later from filing under Chapter 660, challenging their confinement.
Did the state in 2009 essentially tell Mr. Eason, you can bring whatever claim you need to bring under Rule 40?
Yes, the state did. That was before decision like a Brero.
Is that a waiver of your argument here?
I would argue no, because jurisdiction can always be challenged, and this ultimately comes down to a question of whether there's jurisdiction for Rule 40.
What were the circumstances in which that statement were made?
I believe it was his second Rule 40 petition, or an appeal.
Instead of filing?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
But he'd already filed a Rule 40 petition at that point as well.
If Rule 40 was scrapped in Mr. Eason's case, is also Rule 40's provisions that he has filed a couple petitions before and knowingly waived those and extraordinary circumstances and all those things also out the window?
I don't believe so, because if you looked at it that way, then you would have to look at everyone who's been released for a Rule 40 has also wiping out that. And I'm not arguing that people...
Well, we're talking right now. You are right now arguing henceforth Rule 40 is gone.
Yes.
And then, therefore, it seems that in this particular case, Eason's in the game.
Perhaps, but under Chapter 660, I believe the state would have a good argument still that his confinement is legal. And I'm not basing... My argument isn't just that Rule 40 replaces habeas corpus. That's this court's argument. That's what this court said in 1976 in Oley versus Chang. It said that because of Rule 40, habeas corpus is going to be abolished for post-conviction proceedings. That's a footnote in that decision. So it's not just my interpretation that this isn't just a process or a procedure. This isn't just taking Chapter 660 and changing it and tweaking the way it's worked out. This court said when it made the rule that it was wiping out habeas corpus. And that is a violation of the Constitution, because habeas corpus can't be abolished. And it can't even be suspended by this court. It can only be suspended by the legislature. And ultimately, that's what this comes down to. Now, if that means Mr. Eason gets another bite at the apple because Rule 40 is invalid, That's fair. It's fair to get the law right. It's fair to get the procedure right.
But thousands of other defendants would get that as well, correct?
Yes, going forward, absolutely.
No, not just going forward, going back.
Well, if
all the folks who brought Rule 40s and had them denied, and or folks who, they would all be able to reopen those proceedings. Say, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I proceeded under the incorrect provision, and now...
As they are completely able to today, because the habeas corpus statutes in Chapter 660, unlike Rule 40, don't mention waivers, don't mention a knowing and understanding waiver. So arguably, Rule 40 also abridges the rights of defendants today, because Chapter 660 doesn't take into account whether there's a waiver or not. So that's another reason why Rule 40 is invalid. I recognize that's probably not good for the state, but it is, in my opinion, the correct assessment of the law. And that's, if the court has no further questions, I have nothing else to add.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ku iluna, please rise. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.